I'm Judy Pierce, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to start off by thanking the committee for asking me here. And Craig and I have enjoyed this weekend very much, and it was very much needed. We've had a rough 3 years. And as a matter of fact, this is the first time in 3 years we've had a weekend together, alone, uninterrupted. And it's nice to be able to get to know your husband again and find out he's really doing okay. And I'm real grateful for that. It's been a lovely weekend. The Big Book tells me that my story is to disclose in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I had some good teachers in this program, and they taught me to follow instructions, and I'm grateful for that. I didn't always do that, but they persevered. I talked one time, it's been several years ago, and a lady came up to me after my talk. And she said, "Judy, I really enjoyed your story very much. But don't you think you could clean it up a little bit?" And being that I am open-minded by this time, I thought, you know, maybe I better look at this. So I went back to the room and I looked at my story and where I could clean it up, and I came to the conclusion that if I cleaned up my story, I would not have a story. Okay? I get about as general as I can get without missing the points. And what I share with you a lot about, to say what I will share with you a lot about, is primarily about the way I felt. You see, my actions will be different from many of you. The way that I behaved during my drinking will be different from a lot of you. But you will all know how I felt. You'll all understand how I felt. And when I say all of us, I don't mean just the alcoholics. Because I have found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that the Al-Anons feel the same way. And I will tell you, I have a lot of respect for Al-Anons. I love Al-Anons. Al-Anons are a gutsy bunch of broads, I'll tell you. You know, they did things stone cold sober. I had to have a quart under my belt before I could do it. I love those gals, and later on, as I share with you, I'll go into that more as to why I have such a respect for Al-Anon. I was born into a Polish Catholic home, and I really could stop right there. I don't know how many of you know Polacks, but we do drink a lot, and so do Catholics. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was concerned I might be the only Catholic here. And that concern was removed because the first speaker I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous was Father Hillary. Now, and I thought, boy, if he can do it, then it's okay for me. And I love that man. I came into this, and things were really okay. There wasn't anything. The thing that I see in a lot of alcoholics and I hear from a lot of alcoholics is that from my very first memory, I was different. And I can't tell you where I was different or how I was different, but I was different. And as a child, I stuttered horribly at that. It was difficult for me to speak, you know, and I isolated. But in isolating, I did something positive with that. I read a lot. I enjoyed reading as a child. And I would get into those books, and I'd stay into those books and those fairy tales, you know, and I loved them. And for some reason, I felt safe and secure when I was in the midst of those stories. I just loved them. And that was the kind of a thing, I think that's where I picked up the Prince Charming thing. You know, that somebody was going to rescue me from all of this. Was when I read those fairy tales. But I loved reading as a kid. As I got a little older, I just quit stuttering. I don't know what happened. But I was so thrilled with it that I used to give oral reports on all these books I read. And I would stand before the class and give oral reports, and I'd give them daily if the teacher would let me, because I could finally speak like other people spoke, you know. But I still had some problems fitting in. I still didn't feel like I was a part of. My mother was divorced when I was 5. She remarried when I was about 6 and a half. And into our life came what I thought was a wonderful and beautiful man. And he was a fun-loving man. And he was a caring man. And very sensitive. You know? And I did not know, nor did my mother know, that what she had married was an alcoholic in the early stages of alcoholism. And that beautiful, caring, loving man was to change in the years to come. I don't want to stay a whole lot in the childhood thing tonight. I'll make it brief, and I'm going to make it brief in the sense that I'll tell you what my home was like growing up. By the time I was 12, my stepfather was a full-blown alcoholic. I took my first drink at the age of 10. And there was something there that I think I need to remember, is that first drink was wonderful. No. There was nothing about the drug alcohol I didn't like. I loved the way it smelled. I loved the way it tasted. I loved the way it went down. I loved the way it just kind of opened you up and set you free. I loved everything about it. Everything about the drug alcohol. I never took any drugs in my drinking career because I didn't need to. Alcohol did everything for me I wanted it to do. Everything. And I'm not saying that to be sanctimonious, and I'm not saying that to be pious, because I can promise you, if it hadn't worked, I'd have found something. I would have found something to take me out of where I was. But as the disease progressed in the home and the family got sicker, violence became a way of life in our house. And I was raised in one of those alcoholic homes where, you know, we fought. And we didn't just fight verbally, we fought physically. You know, I was sexually abused. And that has been something that I've been able to come to grips with. And I've been able to deal with. And thank God I've been able to forgive. And I have done that through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I have healed. And I'm so grateful. I am so grateful. Now, it was through a lot of loving and a lot of caring and a lot of people that cared a lot about me. And I'm grateful to them for that. But I started getting slapped around a lot, I guess when I was about 11 or 12. And part of this, you must understand, too, I was a rebellious alcoholic. And I had the personality, and I had a mouth on me even then, that would test a man of great patience, let alone someone who was alcoholic. And I'd get knocked across the room, and this went on for a couple of years, and by the time I was about 14 years old, I decided I wasn't going to take this anymore. And I got hit, and I got knocked on the floor, and I picked myself up, and I swung my first punch. And it hit him right on the jaw. And I will share with you, it felt wonderful for me. It just felt wonderful for me. And that was a habit that I started and that I was to maintain for quite some time, even after I got sober. Violence was just kind of a way that I solved things. And I sought out people who solved their problems that way. Now, if you haven't come to the conclusion by now, you're not going to hear a Danish story. I was a barroom brawler. Okay. I didn't know anybody who drank sherry. I ran with the kind of people that sat down at a bar and ordered a shot and a beer. No. And that's the way it was for me. So I find it so absolutely amazing that I can stand before you today with any semblance of sanity at all. Any at all. So this was to go on, and long and the short of the whole story is around 19 or 20. I left home, and it was after a fight. My stepfather quit hitting me when I was about 17, and we got in a fight one night, and he broke my nose, and I had to go to the hospital. I beat up pretty bad that time. And when I got back home, I was sick, because if you've ever had your nose set, that's really painful. And I was sick, and I was in the bathroom, and he came up and started to apologize, and I just whipped around and said, "You ever lay a hand on me again, and I'll kill you." And he believed me. And he never did. And as I say, about 2 years later, I left. And I had a good little job. And I think what's important for me to remember is that my outside appearances, despite what was going on in that household, the outside appearance had to be good. And those are the kind of things that would run me crazy. And growing up and into my adult years, you know, we had to look good on the outside. We had to live in the right neighborhood. We had to drive the right car. He had to work for the right firm. The appearance had to be good. It mattered not what happened to that in that house once you got home. But on the outside, you look good. And the hypocrisy of that drove me insane. No. I was one of those kids, too, who used to worry. I worried about everything. And I was frustrated because it felt to me like there was nothing I could do. And I worried about things like the Vietnam War, because we're talking 60s here, when I'm in my teens. And I used to worry about the Vietnam War, you know, and why is that war going on? And why are guys I'm going to high school with getting blown to bits over there and nobody knows why? And I'd come home at night and turn the TV on, and there'd be riots in the streets, and there'd be people getting beat up with billy clubs and chewed up with dogs. And I think, my God, you know, I don't want to be a part of this. I don't want to be a part of this. It was horrible to me. It was painful. Everything hurt. Every part of life hurt. The truth of the matter is, and some folks don't like to hear this, but I firmly believe if it hadn't been for the drug alcohol, I'd have blown my brains out at 16. Everything was painful. Everything. I started working before I left high school. I made the decision that I was not going to go to college because in my sick mind, I thought you couldn't drink at college. You know, I thought I'd get there and there'd be some little matron with her hair pulled back and tight lips, and every time you walked in, she'd be smelling breath. And I knew that I couldn't handle getting kicked out of college for drinking, so I just didn't go. And what I see in looking back over my inventories is that was the first major, major decision I made. Life-changing decision based on alcohol. That was the first one I made. There were to be many thereafter. And there, of course, were many preceding. But that was one that was based solely and wholly on booze. And I went to work, as I said, before I left high school, and then it was in retail. And then I got a nice little job at a nice big department store. And it pleased Mama. It pleased Mama very much. You see, because Mama knew that her daughter had a problem, but Mama didn't want to talk about it. And because if you don't talk about it, you don't recognize it, it'll all go away. So now I have this nice job, and alcoholics fall upstairs, and I was no exception. And in a short period of time, I had a little badge that said manager. And Mother and my stepfather were so proud. They were so proud. And Mama called the Queen Polack up in Michigan to tell her. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. She was just so pleased. And you see, what it did for her was say, there is nothing wrong with my daughter. At that time, I was 19 years old, and I was the youngest head of sales Richard's ever had. And I had 40 women working under me that were 2 and 3 times my age. And that just didn't happen. But, you know, I had to compensate for myself for what I really felt on the inside. And then, so I overworked. I also had a very expensive habit to support. Great, because by this time now, I'm drinking better than a quart a day. And usually I started off when I got off from work. And I'll give you a real quick rundown of what my days were like. I went to work right at 9:30, and I got off somewhere between 6 and 7, just depending on how the day goes. And I rode the bus, and I'd ride the bus to the corner there by the apartment. I'd get off, I'd walk to the liquor store, and I'd buy my quart, and I'd buy my six-pack for the evening, and I'd go home. And I'd drink on that quart, and I'd drink on the six-pack of beer. And at this stage, I was drinking PBR Talls. And I'd chug a lug those things real quick, and then I'd get started on the liquor. And I'd drink till about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And then I'd decide I needed to make some phone calls, get some people straightened out. You know how we do. And this wisdom comes to us when we get about half lit, you know, and we know we have the answers to all of it. So I'd get them straightened out, and by now it's about 10 o'clock, and then I'd get struck with loneliness. Oh, God, I'd get so lonely. And I'd sit there and wallow in being so lonely. So I'd go to the corner bar to see who I could fall in love with that night. And that's exactly what I did. And I'd go up there and I'd size them up and I'd look them over. And I'd decide which one was going to be my Prince Charming. For that night anyway. And I'd take them home. And this didn't go on just every once in a while. This wasn't something I did every now and then. This was a way of life. And then I'd have to try and come to in the morning and try and get my act together enough to go to work. I was at a conference one time, and there was a guy, one of my male counterparts, up sharing his story. And he went into great detail about all the dogs he slept with while he was drinking. And the following night, it was my turn. And I let him know that he didn't look so good the morning after either. Now, you know, we talk a lot about that, and I joke a lot about that, and I get kidded a lot about it, and that's all fine and good, but you all know what the feeling is. And I'll share with you what my feelings were. Most of the times when I got up the morning after, he was no longer there, whoever he was. 90% of the time, I never knew his name. And I can remember looking in the mirror and thinking to myself, why are you living like this? You know better than to live like this. This is not right. This is stupid. Why are you living like this? And that would haunt me all day long until the next night. And you and I both know what I had to do to fix that. I had to stop one more time and get off of that bus and buy that six-pack and that quart so that I didn't have to hear that same thing going on all night long. And it just kept going. And it just kept going. Never quit. Never stopped. Eventually, I came into work one morning. I was accused of drinking on the job. I wasn't. I just hadn't quit drinking until 5:30 that morning, so obviously I still smelled like liquor. And they didn't fire me. I lied to them, but long and short of that was I ended up quitting. We do that, don't we, when we know. It's right around the corner just any minute now. So I quit, and I made a brilliant decision based on clear alcoholic thinking, and that was that I needed to get into something that was more exciting than retail. You know, and I'm 21 now, and I need a husband because I'm a good Catholic. I should have been married and had one child by now. No, but I needed to get married, and I needed to meet some nice guys, so I decided the best thing for me to do was to go into the bar and restaurant business. And that was one of those brilliant decisions I made. And I went into the bar business, and I maintain that's why I got into this program at 23. And I worked, my shift started at 4 in the afternoon. And my bar was attached to a restaurant in Atlanta, and we closed that bar up at midnight. And from midnight until, we drank. And there were a bunch of us in the bar and restaurant business, and there was one place you could go to, and at 2 o'clock she'd lock the door. And you could sit in there and drink till dawn, and we did. And we'd sit around and drink, and sometimes we'd sing, and sometimes we'd fight, and sometimes we'd fight and sing. It just didn't matter. But there were never a lot of fun times for me in the drinking. There were a lot of nights that started out fun. There were a lot of times that I thought I would tell myself, you're not going to do this. You're only going to go this far and no more. And by the time I got this far, I'd forgotten. And I just kept going. You know, and it was the same routine it'd been when I was working at the department store. I was still taking guys home, and I didn't know who they were. And I was getting to the point now physically where I couldn't eat. You know, the shakes had long been a part of my daily life. Getting sick in the morning had long been a part of my daily life. That was just routine. But now it was getting to the point that I couldn't work. And I promise you, I could not allow it to be the alcohol. It can be anything else but the booze. Don't take away the booze. It's all I got. It's the only thing that allows me to go out there and function. It's the only thing that allows me to go out there and cope. It can't be the booze. It's got to be something else. And so I started on the road to therapy. Now, I was not wealthy by any means, so I went to 8th Floor Grady. I was an outpatient there. And I was so pleased because my therapist there deemed it all my stepfather's fault. And I was so grateful. And after 6 months of therapy with him, I left. I stayed drunk the whole time that I was in therapy. And I got even drunker when he told me it was all his fault, because I knew that would be true to begin with. But the drinking wouldn't stop. If that was the reason, why didn't the drinking stop? It just didn't stop. I'd fall in love a lot. I'd get engaged a lot. I used to get engaged a lot, because I'd make these decisions, and then there's always somebody who's going to change you. No, there is something wrong with you, and I'm the one that's going to fix you. And I'd find one of these guys, and the truth of the matter is, they kind of had like a banner, you know, and you knew they were coming, and you'd see them, and you'd think, that's the one that's going to take care of me. And so I'd bring them in, and they'd stay with me. They'd live at wherever I was, and they'd pick up the rent, and they'd pay the bills for a month or so. No, and then they'd split, because nobody could live with me. I was explosive. My temper was explosive. And I wasn't the kind that just screamed. I was the kind that went for a butcher knife. You know, I was the kind that would break a bottle and come at you. I was insane. I was sitting at a bar one time, and one guy was walking behind me with his buddy. You know how they have the mirrors in there, you know, so you can look at yourself while you're getting sauced? And they were walking behind me. And one guy was going to hit on me, and the other guy said, don't touch her, man. Don't say nothing to that chick. The woman's crazy. I'm telling you, she'll kill you. And he backed off. And I remember that. And those are the kind of things that would roll in your head over and over and over again. The woman's crazy. The woman's crazy. She'll kill you. And see, what was frightening about that is they were right. They were right. If you crossed me, chances were pretty good I'd try to kill you. In short, I was little more than an animal. Little more. And if there had not been some souls around to save some other folks, I would have been. Impossible for me to understand and believe. Just impossible. As this situation went on, and I kept drinking, and I kept trying to work in different bars, and I couldn't hold jobs much longer. I would work for a place 2 weeks. And I started off working one of the nicest places in Atlanta, and I ended up at a place called the Blue Cockatoo. And she didn't pay you to work there. You worked for tips only. And if you worked there, you better carry a knife, because it was that kind of place. It was a rough place. Couldn't hold a job there. Finally just didn't show up. I'd met a guy that I'd known when I was working in the business. And you meet a lot of people in that kind of business, and not all of them are real nice people. This man's name was Pearl. Pearl had tried to get me to go to work for him many times, and I said, no, I'll just keep in the bar and keep serving drinks. But the money finally ran out, and the men finally ran out, and there was nothing there. And the booze was running out. And I called Pearl one night. Said, I gotta have some cash, man, and I gotta have it fast. It's all gone. And I went to work for Pearl that night as a hooker on the streets of Atlanta. Because that's all I had left to do. That's all there was. And you see, I had reached the point on the inside where it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. I couldn't care less. I'd been sleeping around. I might as well charge for it. What's the difference? It just didn't matter. I stayed drunk all the time. I never let go of that buzz. And I can remember walking in and out of those flea bag hotels, and even the guys that worked there looked down on me. These slum hotels in Atlanta. And I wore the uniform. Hey, I had the uniform for the ladies of the 70s, early 70s. And I know some of you in here remember them. You remember those white vinyl go-go boots, right? Used to have them, they're short shorts, we used to call them hot pants. Mine were green satin, class, see. And I wore black fishnet hose. And my hair was very, very long and straight. And it was naturally black then. And, always wore it hanging over one eye. Always. Because that meant I was sexy. And I always had a cigarette hanging out of the corner of my mouth. I'm talking all the time. If I talked to you, it stayed in there. And it just bobbed up and down, and I'd just carry on a conversation. It didn't bother me. And I never stood up straight. I always leaned against something, because that meant I was tough. That and a cigarette hanging out of the corner of my mouth. See? Because I wanted to project to you, leave me alone. And then I had a mouth that was horrid. My mouth was terrible. It embarrasses me when I think about some of the things I said. And I got to tell you something, this is true. I work as a floral designer now. I don't know how that fits, but that's where I ended up. But anyway, and I was in the store the other day, and a customer came in, and right after I had gotten sober, I went to work for a temporary service, just doing some menial filing and accounting jobs. And this lady came in, and she said to me, "You worked at Goldkist about 20 years ago, didn't you?" And I thought, oh my God, how could you remember that? And she said, "I remember your voice." And I thought, it's not the voice you remembered. It's what the voice said you remembered. Because I know how I talked about 20 years ago. And it didn't matter to me that I was in an office environment at all. Not at all. And I thought, God, that must have been pretty bad if she can remember back 20 years. I got, that didn't last very long, because the truth of the matter was I couldn't stay sober long enough to walk the streets. Even in that profession, you got to be able to walk, and I couldn't do it. Just too much. And I checked myself in. I called my mama, and best as I remember, I was nuts. I was absolutely stark raving insane. Called her screaming something, and the long and short of that is I signed myself into a state institute, and I was to reside there for a little better than 6 months. And the kicker to this one is I wasn't hospitalized for alcoholism. I was hospitalized for being suicidal homicidal. And that's scary. Because, you see, they had to have 7 doctors certify that. They put you in this little room and they all sit and stare at you. Which is a wonderful thing to do to somebody who's paranoid and hostile. that's the conclusion they came to. And what that, in essence, of course, means is I just assume... I place no value on human life at all, is what it meant. I didn't care whether you lived, and I didn't care whether I lived, because there just simply was no value there. And to try and alleviate some of that violence that I had, they would put me on little pills, you know, and they put me on some, I believe it was Milleril, and I screamed and hollered about that stuff because you just kind of floated. You never heard anything, you never saw anything. But they did that with patients like me because I was explosive and I had a tendency to stir up the ward. And you get one patient that explosive and the whole ward kind of goes crackers. So so they would put me on those pills to keep me quiet and everybody would be happy. And it took me a month and a half to get off of those things under doctor's supervision. It was a bad scene. And that whole 6 months was a bad scene. One of the things that has kept me sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is the fear that I may have to go back to a place like that on a permanent basis. I don't know how many of you have ever been there, but I will tell you that this place was not nice. This was not one of those places where we had swimming pools and tennis courts. Okay. I was on a locked ward. And there's not a quiet night in one of those places. And I don't care what they give you to knock you out, you can still hear the screams. And you can still hear the bizarre laughing. And you can still hear the people crying. And you don't forget it. And it'll keep you sober. Because I don't ever want to go back there. I don't ever want to go back there. They had told me that I hadn't been a good patient, and I therefore could not have a pass. And I ran the best con I'd ever run in my life. And inside of 3 weeks, I was out of that place. I was only out on a 3-hour pass, mind you, but I never went back. And I left, of course, as the way I always pulled out of town, with a man and a case of liquor. And they called my mother trying to find me, and 10 to 14 days later, Mom and I tried to piece this together, and we never had been able to. Somebody brought me to my mother's home. And poured me on the sofa in her den. And my mama was to come home from work that day. to find her 23-year-old daughter 10 days without a bath or a change of clothes, stinking from booze and sleeping with men. We have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous regarding making amends. I don't think that I can ever make amends for the heartbreak I put that woman through. I don't think that going up and saying, "I'm sorry, Mom," is enough. Because this wasn't the first time. This was the worst time, but it wasn't the first. "I'm sorry, Mom," is just not enough. So for me to live with me, what I have done is, in essence, made that step a daily step. And on a daily basis, I am the best daughter I can be. You know? And that means that when I'm tired and I'd really rather sit and watch TV, I call Mama. And when I'm tired and the phone rings and it's Mom and she just wants to chit-chat about the new haircut her Pekingese got, I listen. You know, that's my way of making amends. Our big book even tells us that a man who thinks that stopping drinking is enough is wrong. That is wrong. I don't know about you, but I've known a few people who stopped drinking and they were more miserable than they ever were drunk. No. So stopping drinking is not enough. I don't feel I am making amends to my family because I put the sauce down. Well, yippee-doo. If I continue to be selfish and self-centered and uncaring and consumed with myself and my problems, I'm no better sober than I was drunk. So it's a daily thing for me. Oh. And I'm grateful. I'm real grateful. I left there and I tried to commit suicide, no big deal. Popped a bottle of pills, sat down, waited to die. My baby sister came out of her bedroom for absolutely no reason that I know of, other than there was somebody upstairs watching out for me. Went and woke up my mother and said, "We got to get Judy to the hospital. There's something wrong." Now, that kid had seen me passed out drunk more than she'd seen me sober. And I firmly believe that God told her there's something wrong here. And I got to a hospital, and there's another shrink, and he comes in to talk to me. And he tells me about what I need to do, and he wants me to sign up for his group therapy. And I told him in no uncertain terms what he could do with his group and his therapy. And I got up, and I stomped out of there. And I was so angry. And the following is frightening, because he went to my mother, and once again, this woman who is distraught, you know, who I've put through all this stuff, he went to her and he said, "Save yourself a lot of grief and have her committed. Your daughter wants no help. She will never get well." What do we do to our families when they're faced with those kind of decisions? How does a mother look at her firstborn child and say, "I'm going to have to commit her to an institute for the rest of her natural life because she is of danger to herself and to society"? What do we do? Oh. And Mama couldn't do that. She did the greatest thing that she'd ever done for me. The following day, she threw me out. She told me, "You pack your bags and you get out of here. I have had it with you and your behavior, and you're no longer welcome here. Get out." And I remember I was so angry with her. Oh, God, was I angry with her. How could she? How could she? And I was about 4 years sober before I realized how much love that really took. No. Went to stay with my cousin Joe. Joe is a beautiful, wonderful person, and we are like sisters. Just like sisters, and I care so much for her. And Joe was going to help me get sober and get my life in order, and inside of 3 weeks she said, "You got to pack your bags and go. I've never seen anybody drink like you, ever." And the day that she said that was December 18th, 1972. And I was very sick. Physically. And I was worn out. I was 23 years old. And I was ancient. I felt like I had been at war for centuries. Everything inside of me was old and dying. Everything.
And why I asked her to call Alcoholics Anonymous, I have no idea. I have no idea. You know. But she called, and they said they'd be there at 7:15, and they were. I started getting ready at a little bit before 5, because I was not a well person. Joe had to help me bathe. I still remember her trying to lift me out of that tub, and I shook so bad I thought both of us were going to end up drowning right there in that tub. And she pulled me out of there, and she helped me to get dressed, and I did the best I could to some makeup on. You know, you got to look good. Couldn't walk, but the cosmetics had to be right. And I went to my first meeting. I got to tell you about the 12-step call. This was glorious. Now, Joe loaned me a decent civilian outfit to wear because I didn't have many decent clothes, and I just didn't think that satin and leather was apropos for an AA meeting. And that's all I had. I just didn't have any civilian clothes. And she loaned me a little pantsuit, and I had to wear my boots, and had the hair hanging down over the eye, and I had one leg thrown over the arm of a little chair, and a cigarette hanging out of the corner of my mouth when the two AAs arrived. The first one to walk in was a good-looking man. I still think he was one of the best-looking men I've ever seen in my life. And he was so clean. Oh, he was so clean. And he had on a beautiful sweater. And his hair was combed, and he's clean-shaven, and God, he smelled good. And I thought, now, this is a good organization here. Now, yeah. This one, I'll fit right in here, boy. This is fine. But right behind him came Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm. And I'll never forget this one either. The hair was cropped short, and every little curl in place. I mean, there wasn't a hair out of place. She had on a brown princess double-breasted coat, and with the velvet collar. I'll never forget that velvet collar. Little bitty heels and white gloves. And she walked up to me with those pearly white teeth, grinning from ear to ear, and said, "Hi, I'm..." What kind of name is that for a bunny? We were walking out of the apartment, and as I said, it was December, and it was cold, and there was little ice on the step, and Bunny reached over to grab my hand, and I pulled away from her quickly. And she looked at me, and she said, "I just don't want you to fall." But what she saw in me that night was what I was. "Don't touch me. Don't you lay a hand on me. I don't care if I fall. I don't want your help. Leave me alone." They talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. My first question to them was, "How much is this thing going to cost me? I haven't got any insurance." Pearl didn't have a group coverage kind of thing, you know. Buddy said, "It's not going to cost you a dime." And I sat there for a minute, and I didn't know what to say. He said, "The only thing we ask of you to do," and I thought, here it is. This is it, is that when somebody calls, that you do just exactly what we're doing. And I said, okay, no big deal, because I had no intentions of ever doing it, so it didn't matter to me. That's all they said. You know, all I had to do was make a promise. I'd been doing that for years and not keeping it, so it was no big deal. And we went to my first meeting, and it was great. It was in a church. The thing I remember the most about my first meeting is the laughter. I think that's what a lot of alcoholics remember, is the laughter. And it wasn't the kind of laughter that we had around the piano bar. It was the kind that came from deep within and just kind of radiated all over, you know. And I remember that laughter. I remember that. I remember at the very end of the meeting, because I just kind of sat there and listened to everybody, and I was real foggy, and Joe went with me, and she held my hand during the meeting, you know. And there was one guy there who got me a half a cup of coffee. I thought, boy, he's smart. He's smart. Because if he'd have given me a full one, everybody in that meeting would have been wearing it. At the end of the meeting, Buddy looked at me, the man that made the 12-step call. And he said, "Judy, is there anything you'd like to ask? Is there anything you'd like to know about us?" And all of a sudden, all the toughness was gone, and I was scared. And I said, no. I just don't want to drink anymore. I am sick to death of being drunk. And you know, I can feel the same way that I felt that night, because I was so sick of being drunk. I was so sick of being dirty, of not being able to bathe myself, and not being able to clean the place that I lived. I was so sick of not being able to walk anywhere without being fearful. I was so sick of the whole thing. I was just sick of being drunk. And Buddy reached across the table and he patted my hand. And he said, you don't ever have to be drunk again, honey. You don't ever have to drink again. That was December the 18th, 1972. I haven't had a drink since. I picked up my white chip that night, and I still have that white chip. And thank God it's the only one that I have. And I share that with you, not so that you'll think I'm patting myself on the back, but that you'll know it can be done. Okay. I shared one time that I only had one white chip, and somebody said, well, good for you. No. Well, he'd been bragging all during the meeting. He had 35. Why can't I say something about just having one? And I got into this program. Well, now, I'd been going to a nice group on the best side of town. You know I had to, because I got to keep up the image, right? Isn't that ludicrous? I mean, you know, I'm working the streets, but I'm going to go to the north side of town, so I'll be accepted in AA. stupid. So anyway, I go there, but as I said, my mouth was not, I mean, I just said anything. It was really bad. And I didn't realize that sober men weren't quite as willing as drinking men were. So I was making a play for a lot of the guys in the group, and a lot of their wives attended the Al-Anon meeting there. So I was making some folks uncomfortable. The beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is there are some who know, well, just intuitively know. And one of the ladies came up to me, actually she was the bravest of the bunch, and she said to me, she said, I think that you would enjoy another group on the other side of town, I'd like to tell you how to get there. So she gave me the name of a group called the Biscayne. And I'm very grateful to her that she did, because I was beginning to see that I didn't dress, walk, talk, act like these ladies that were in this group. You know, I began to feel that. I wasn't there yet. Now, what I want to share with you is that it's not that I was never taught any social skills. That's not the way it was. What had happened, you see, is that those social skills I had been taught became too difficult. It was just easier to operate on impulse. You know, I didn't want to look at what was right and what was wrong and what was acceptable and what was unacceptable. I just did what I wanted to do. And if you keep doing that for years, it becomes habit. And you forget the good things that were taught to you, because they're too difficult to do. When you're drunk, it's too difficult to be nice, to be polite, to say, excuse me. It's just too difficult. No. So they sent me to this group. I walked into a group of people that were just like me. And this, to me, is so very important. The men, there were two men in this group, and I will love them forever, forever. One was Dad, and one was Big Jim. Dad had 8 years sobriety, and Big Jim had 12. And they just kind of took care of me. They just kind of took me under their wing. They were the kind of sponsors that were more concerned about you living than you getting your feelings hurt. You know? Now, I never formally called them sponsors, but they were my sponsors. I didn't formally call anybody sponsor. I wasn't going to have a sponsor. I didn't need a sponsor. But I went to them for so much. For so much. I came into the room. I had about 3 months sobriety, and I came into the room one day, and I was angry. Oh, I was so angry. And Dad saw it right away. Now, you got to understand, Dad stood about 5'5", and maybe would have weighed 135 soaking wet. Meaner than a snake. That was the meanest man. He was an old merchant marine, retired. Had tattoos all up his arm. And he could get that finger right in your face and just put the fear of God in you. And I came in one day and I was real mad. I'm stomping back towards the back of the room. He said, where are you going? I said, you see that broad back there? I didn't actually call her a bride, but I don't like to cuss from the podium. And he said, yes. And I said, I've had it with her mouth. Man, I'm taking her outside. He said, get you a cup of coffee and sit down. That was not suggested. You know, the way he said it, I knew it would be to my advantage to get that coffee and sit down. And I got the coffee and I sat down. Dad had his own recliner there, you know, and he had his recliner. He's sitting in the recliner and I sit in a little ottoman right in front of him. And he said, Judy, he said, if you want to stay sober, you got to quit hitting people. And I'm sitting there like a kid hearing a Christmas story. You know, none of this is registering here. And he said, hitting people is not socially acceptable behavior. And I just sat there. And then he gave me a gift, and I give it to you. He said, Judy, you can't live like a drunk and expect to stay sober. And I started looking at things that I was doing that was living like a drunk. You know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Well, now I'm not in the program long, and I want to clean up my act. Okay, I decide I need to get married. That is not hard to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. Didn't take me long. I guess I met this guy when I was about 12 days sober. And I think, I got married when I was 4 months sober. And he had 5 months sobriety. And the deacons in that group just sat back and waited for the feathers to fly. You know, it was just kind of like an amusement soap opera thing with them. And we were to make another brilliant decision based on newcomer thinking. And that is, we need to get out of the big city and go to a nice little quiet community. Now, I want y'all to remember, first of all, the hair is still hanging in the eyes. I'm still wearing the white boots. And because I didn't come into a lot of money when I got sober. I was never one of those to get a job right away and clean up my act. And we move ourselves to Hiawassee, Georgia. Now, in 1973 in Hiawassee, Georgia, you did not walk the main streets of Hiawassee in white go-go boots, green satin hot pants, and a halter. But I was doing the best I could. And we lived up there on and off for about a year and a half, but the joy of that whole stay up there and that whole move up there was a beautiful place for me, where there was a lake up there. There was an 8-acre lake up there. Very, very close to my home and close to the business that we were trying to get going. My ex and I had a horrible fight. And for the first time in sobriety, it was raw pain against raw nerves. And I was crying. Oh, I was crying so hard. And went out by that lake, and I sat down, and I looked up, and there's a beautiful mountain back there. And I didn't have much use for God, you know. I mean, he really dealt me a bad deal in the cards, man, and I just didn't have much use for him. And I remember saying, God, I don't know if you're up there, and I don't know if you can hear me, but I got to have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. And it was as though a good friend came out of nowhere and put his hand on my shoulder and said, you're going to be okay, kid. You're going to be okay. He didn't come down and give me answers and say, you need to do this and this and this. I just knew in here I was going to be okay. What is so important is for the first time in my life, for the first time in my life, I was a child of God. For the first time in all the praying, I knew He loved me. There wasn't a doubt in my mind that He wanted nothing but good for me, no matter what I had done, no matter what I had been, that my Heavenly Master loved me. And I'll never forget that. And I just feel good every time I share that, because I remember the warmth and I relive that warmth. See, I wasn't a little piece of trash anymore. I'd had people tell me, you're nothing but trash and you're never going to be anything but trash, woman. Get out of my face. You know, I'd heard people tell me, you stay away from my children. I don't want my kids to see a woman like you. I'd heard all that. Never had I felt like I was a part of. Never. Never had I felt like I was one of God's children. The miracle to me of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I came in to you all and I didn't care. I knew I was alcoholic and I just, by God, didn't care. It just didn't matter. And what I had hoped was I could get my act together long enough to go back out there and do it again. That's what I had hoped. And somewhere that all changed to where I started caring. I don't know where it happened. I don't know. I just started caring. They talked to me about working with newcomers, and the first thing I could do was a brand new man came in, and we had a place where people stay for 3 days and dry out. And the best that I could do for him was, he was going through the cold sweats, and I went and I got him a blanket. And I covered up his shoulders, and I said, I hope you feel better. And then I ran away and sat down so nobody'd see me being nice. Oh, I didn't want anybody seeing me be nice. After I came back to Atlanta from the stay in Hiawassee, I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because for some reason, there was a reason to do it now. For some reason, maybe this thing would work. No. And I began to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd always loved you all. You were always special to me. But I began to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. With the program. With the learning about living sober. No. And that's the things that Jim did for us. For those of us that came in back then. Jim taught us how to live sober. Jim taught us how to have fun. You know, they invited me to a barbecue one time with other couples. I mean, you know, at their house, in their backyard, where the public could see me. No, I'd never done stuff like that. And when I was sitting over in the corner kind of by myself because I was scared, Jim forced me to come out and be a part of. He said, come on over here, dude, we need your help on this. Come on over here, we need your help on that. And they took me to public places to eat, you know, out to restaurants and stuff. It was unbelievable. They wanted me to be with them. I went out one time, I managed to scrape $5 together, and I bought a pair of blue jeans, and it was the first baggy blue jeans I ever owned in my life. And they had little yellow ducks on them, you know. And I bought those because I thought they'd be kind of feminine and something a little different, you know, a little lady-like maybe to wear. And then I went to, it was at, I remember it was a Sears outlet store, because that was the only place I could get an outfit for $5. And then I got a little yellow blouse to go with them, and I wore it to the meeting that night. And I was so proud of my new outfit, you know, and it was a decent outfit. I mean, it was decent, you know, it was something that normal women would wear. And one of the ladies came up to me and she said, you look so pretty. It's so nice to see you getting sober. Now, the jeans were way too big and the blouse didn't fit well. But Julia knew how important that was to me. She knew how important. You know, and I used to think it was just me, that I didn't get along with the women, that I was afraid of the women. No, I used to think it was just me. I'm going to share with you something now that kind of bothers me, but it's the way I feel. And it's why I'm as open and as honest as I can be with you. I think it is a crying shame that people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and clean up their act so well that young women have to walk in and think they're the only ones. I think that is absolutely pathetic. No, it is awful. When I walked in here, my guts were torn out. I didn't need any more condemning. I didn't need any more judgment. No. My wish for everybody in here tonight is that none of you ever clean up so well you forget what it's like to be dirty. Don't do that to yourself. And don't do that to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. I hear a lot of people, and I'm fortunate. I get to go to a lot of these. It hasn't been too much here lately because I don't have the time. I used to have a position. Now I have a job. So, in case you don't know the difference, anything that pays over $25,000 a year is a position. I have to take. I hit the clock now, and that's fine. And I'm grateful I have that with the state that things are in right now. And I enjoy the work I do, but I used to get around a lot more. And in getting around a lot, I'd hear people talk about, you know, things aren't like they used to be. You know, sponsors don't do like they used to. And the thing that troubles me is that I'm hearing this from people that have got 18 and 19 years that are supposed to be sponsoring people. Now, my home group is the Night Owls group. So named because our initial meeting was at 11 o'clock on Saturday night. Okay? And in that group, we do it like we used to do it. The newcomers get coffee. The newcomers make coffee. If somebody gets out of line during a meeting, the old members say, sit down and shut up. We didn't call on you. We listened to you, now you'll listen to us. That's the way we do it in our group. Now, I am not worried. I didn't come here to be a counselor. That's not what I can't. I am not qualified to be a counselor. I'm qualified to share with you how I got sober. I am qualified to share with you how I stay sober. And if I hurt your feelings in the midst of that, I'm sorry. But this is not a gentle disease. This disease will kill. It is my opinion only. It is not in the book. It is my opinion only that we are killing more alcoholics than we're helping. Because we don't have the chutzpah to say, knock it off, kid, or you're going to drink. That's what they did for me. And I'm here to tell you, at 2.5 years sobriety, I wasn't sure I wanted anything y'all had. I wasn't sure I wanted it. I'd walk into the room, and I'd throw my purse down on the sofa, and I'd throw my body down on the sofa, and I'd dare one of you to talk to me. But Big Jim and Dad always had a way. Jim would walk by. You got something you want to talk about? No, I don't want to talk about it. All right, stay there and stay sick. I don't care. See, they told me on the onset, my sobriety was my responsibility, not theirs. They would do what they could to help me, but they were not going to nursemaid me. And I sponsor a lot of women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to me that's one of the greatest gifts that you can do for God, is to give back that which He has given you. Okay? And every one of those girls were tough little broads, I'll guarantee you. They were tough. And I am real, real happy that God has allowed me to see some of these gals celebrate 10 and 12 and 15 years sobriety. You know? And I've got one right now that's coming up on 5 years, and believe me, I think God and I are amazed at both of that, that one. I just don't think, I'm not sure he thought we could pull it off, you know. But I sit and listen to her in a meeting and I just well up, you know, and I sit and watch her sponsor the new one, you know. And I got tickled the other day, I was listening to her, and I heard my own words. Because she's got a new one now who keeps saying, I'm thinking about drinking, I'm thinking about drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And she shared with her the same thing I shared with her. Well, then, by God, go on and get drunk. I'm tired of hearing about it. No. Yeah. Because that puts it right back. And see, that was shared with me. That's not original, trust me. Because I wanted to get drunk. I remember 2.5 years I wanted to blow my brains out. And if you're sitting out there with 2.5 to 3 years sobriety and you're wanting to kill yourself, you're getting better. You're getting in. Don't let anybody tell you you're not. And let me tell you why I really believe that. You see, because for the alcoholic to be in that state of mind and not think about drinking is improvement, honey. It's improvement. Okay? So you're not well, but we're getting better. And you need to talk to your sponsor about it before you do any more. And in the Alcoholics Anonymous and in my home group, we have fun. You see, we have fun. Because sobriety is fun. Sobriety is not just getting up, going to work, coming home, eating a quick dinner, going to meetings, and then sitting around and talking to some screwed up drunk the rest of your life. That's not what it's about. Sobriety is having fun. At my group, we have family cookouts. That means AAs, Al-Anons, Mama if she wants to come, aunts and uncles if they want to come. And we have a whole day of volleyball and football and frisbee. And cookout. And food fights. And it's wonderful. It is wonderful. And it's fun. And it's learning to share, and it's learning to laugh, and it's learning to love.
Alcoholics Anonymous has brought me something I never thought I'd have, and that is some dignity. I never thought I could once again walk with my back straight and looking straight ahead. I never thought that would happen to me. I never thought I would be asked places. I never thought that people would want to talk to me. I never thought that. That is not supposed to happen to women like me. Women like me end up dead in a ditch somewhere. You are not supposed to be able to stand in front of a group of beautiful people and talk about what God has done for you. No, that is Alcoholics Anonymous. No. If your home group is not sending donations to Central Office and to the State Convention and to the other groups that need our support, find out why. And I'm only mentioning that because that's a real ticker with me. Okay? Support your groups. Support your Central Office. This is our life's blood. It's yourself you're supporting when you do this. You know, I'm proud to say that my group sends Central Office money, and we have it divided up just like they say you're supposed to divide it up in the conference-approved literature. And if it's going to buy china for your group, I suggest your group check their priorities. Okay? And that is something that's just, I've heard so much of here lately that I was going to share whether I was running over or not. I just think it's sad that our service office has to ask for an additional donation because we're becoming too dependent on outside contributions for our big book. That's sad. We shouldn't have to do that. Our central office should be self-supporting. Our big book should be self-supporting. We shouldn't have to go to outside sources or worry about they may have enough influence financially that they can tell us how that big book should be written and altered. I can't do that. I want to tell you about something that happened to me last night, and it just blows my mind. I walked into these places, and I always see somebody I haven't seen in a while, but there's always special folks. And I walked in last night, and I saw Ruth and Bob, and I just started crying. Who knows why? Some folks say it's because I'm 42 and it's that time when a woman cries at the drop of the hat. I don't know. But I know I love them both. And I know they're very special to me. And yesterday I was walking out of my room and I saw my buddy Melinda. And she started, of course, Melinda cries at the drop of the hat. You know how she is. She didn't recognize me up front because last time she saw me, I was gray-headed. And I told her that I'd been a blonde and a redhead since I saw her last. It was Navy one time, too. I got a hold of a bad bottle of dye. And Lester, who's heard my story so many times, he could probably tell it. Then I was getting to think this was a high-class operation you had here, and old George from Fargo walked in, and I thought, boy, we're going to the pot now. And it's been lovely. Alcoholics Anonymous allows us the opportunity to get it all. It allows us the opportunity to face those challenges. Those things that come up in life that sometimes don't seem fair. At 10 years sobriety, my husband drank. And it was rough. And I'm not going to tell you that I detached with love. I was going to kill him first, and then I didn't care what happened to him. But I did go to Al-Anon meetings, and what I want to share about that, and I will do this briefly, is that I walked into those Al-Anon meetings, and I was loved, and I was cared for. And I had friends come to me I didn't even know I had. And they shared with me. And people that I'd known in the program, they weren't pesky, and they didn't call and want to know all the details. But what they did were those loving things that people who care about you do. One of my friends knew I'm bad to eat, not to eat when I get real upset. I just won't eat. I mean, literally for days I won't eat. I forget. And he'd call me every day about 1 p.m. Been to lunch yet? No, I hadn't gone yet. Well, when are you going? You got to eat. Every day. Every day he'd call. Because he knew that hungry, angry, lonely, and tired is not good for this alcoholic. so he'd call. No. And they'd stop by the house. Just want to see if you're all right. Stop by the house. Come on, Jude, we're going to get some pizza. You're going with us. It wasn't optional. No. One of my sponsorees came in and said, change your clothes. We need to take you out to eat. I said, wait a minute. This isn't the way this works. We don't do this way. But I changed my clothes, and we went out and got something to eat. I want to tell you that was not easy for Craig or I, and I will not stand in judgment of him. I knew when I married Craig, he was an alcoholic, and the truth of the matter was, it was a 50-50 chance, he or me. Right. And I found out what it's like to love somebody, and I found out what it's like to hurt. And I also am very proud of him, because it's real hard to walk back into a group that you've been sober 10 years and have a young man be sponsored for 10 years give you your watch it. Takes a lot of guts. And I don't know if my ego would allow me to do that. And I love him very much, and since I bragged on him, Pierce, would you stand up, baby, please? Yeah. We've been together 16 years, and there hasn't been a dull moment. Not a dull moment. Alcoholics Anonymous will allow you to do anything you want to do with your life that is good. Don't you let anybody tell you different. Don't let people tell you you can't get an education because it'll interfere with your meetings. If you want sobriety bad enough, you can do it all, honey. You can do every bit of it. Don't shortchange yourself. You shortchange yourself all the time before you got here. You know, God has blessed me. I've got it all. I've got a good marriage. I've got lots of friends. I've got a nice place to sleep on, a clean bed. I got a freezer full of food and a car that runs. What more do I need? Huh? What more do I need? In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are many beautiful paragraphs, but this is one of my favorites, and I always close with it. And if you don't know where it is, you read the book till you find it. And the paragraph says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you all for your attention.